Hello and welcome to a new series of Inside Education podcasts. You will notice that there is no theme tune on this programme. That's because this year the series is going out first as a podcast and will only be broadcast on radio on an occasional basis. I'm doing this because the weekly deadline for programmes was proving tricky at certain times of the year. Nevertheless, through the podcasts I'll continue to bring you programmes about the world of education from an Irish perspective. You can access the full list of podcasts on my website, seandelaney.com. On this week's programme, I bring you an interview with a Canadian man, John Mighton. John Mighton is a playwright, an author, a mathematician and a social entrepreneur. He established a programme of mathematics teaching called Jump Maths, which is promoted through a charitable organisation dedicated to helping children succeed at and enjoy learning mathematics. JUMP is an acronym for Junior Undiscovered Maths Prodigies. The programme aims to help children succeed at and enjoy learning mathematics. It aims to do this by using materials and methods that minimise differences among students. It encourages teachers to keep constant track of the mathematics their students know and reminds teachers that progress in maths can happen in sudden leaps, not always in a steady, linear way. John Mighton was in Ireland to speak to some maths teachers at the start of this school year. I caught up with him during his visit and I began our conversation by asking him to tell me what Jump Maths is.
Well, we're a charity dedicated to helping all kids learn math and love learning math, and helping all teachers also love teaching math. Now serve about 100,000 kids in Canada as their main classroom program, and we're now expanding to other countries too.
I suppose the first word that struck me as being a bit unusual there is the word charity, because usually we associate companies with promoting the teaching and providing teaching materials. So how is Jump Maths different from the charity point of view?
Well, you know, we started as a tutoring club in my apartment, and I volunteered for years just trying to help kids. And I think being a charity has had some advantages. It's had disadvantages because you can't really borrow money or take risks. So that's meant we've grown slowly at first. But being a charity also means that we can concern ourselves more with reach and impact rather than profit. So we've developed our materials over many years and rewritten them based on observations in classrooms and data that we've gathered. So it's, and you know, I've even realized this year we're adapting our materials to these new standards in the States. And looking at traditional approaches, people often group things according to topics because you have to have a very well organized book that will sell to people. But that means sometimes that you have to put things together. You have to introduce things before kids are ready, because say you've clumped place value all together, and there's subtleties that they may not understand right at the beginning of the year that you might want to break up. So you might want to break up place value into several different chapters. And so we've been able to just try and do what's best for the kids and develop materials that work for kids. And we haven't been really constrained by having to make a profit.
So are you saying then that your materials are not necessarily organized by topic?
They are, except we, you know, I'll give you an example. In the U.S. Now, in our new Common Core books, kids have to learn decimal expansion. So 0.7 is 7 times 1/10. Now, if you were to teach that all in one chapter, then it would just be magic. If you don't cover multiplication by a fraction deeply at first, then the kids really don't understand decimal expansion. It's just kind of rote or meaningless to them. So we only treat whole number place value at first and then come back and do decimal place value. And that's we have flexibility to develop the materials in any way we want, really, based on the data we gather.
So what would a typical Jump Maths lesson be like then?
Well, we call the method guided discovery. It evolved over a long period. You know, there's been a big push to discovery-based lessons, having kids figure things out for themselves, understand the math deeply, which has been very positive. And this has been a huge push in North America. But cognitive scientists now are finding that if you don't guide discovery, if you start with problems that are too big or too complex, then the brain just can't handle it. They call it cognitive overload. And kids start to get discouraged and develop anxieties, and their brains just don't work efficiently. But if you guide them in smaller, more manageable steps, but still let them figure things out, then they get very excited. So a typical lesson is a series of Socratic questions or challenges or mini exercises that the teacher delivers, but the kids figure out themselves for the most part, and they're assessed immediately. So there's lots of feedback, immediate feedback. The teacher generally doesn't move on unless everyone has it. If the lesson is very well scaffolded and structured, then generally everyone can move along at the same pace, we found. And there's always, you can always differentiate instruction slightly by having bonus questions for kids who need extra work. But we found if you don't I don't know if you have differentiated instruction in Ireland, but it's that phrase is really now quite widespread in North America. We think the problem is if you differentiate instruction too much, if you assume kids have different abilities or are very different from each other, then you get differentiated outcomes. But we think if you differentiate instruction slightly, you can keep kids at roughly the same, moving at roughly the same pace.
So you'd be talking about a whole class lesson then rather than group work.
All of our lessons come with activities, games, some group work, but we tend to, much of the lesson is a whole class where the kids are all getting excited together. There's a sociologist, Durkheim, who said people never get more excited than when they feel collective effervescence, when they're all experiencing the same thing together. And we've seen that viscerally. We videotaped it. When kids are all experiencing success together, they get extraordinarily excited. I've seen kids beg to stay for recess to do math. I even broke up a fight with a bully once by telling him if he didn't apologize for starting the fight, he wouldn't get his bonus question in math. And he apologized to get a bonus question. So I think there's research that shows that as early as kindergarten, kids start comparing themselves to each other and deciding who's smart and who isn't. And we allow those comparisons to persist. We think they're innocent. But once kids decide they're not in a talented group, you know, they just stop paying attention, taking risks. They're not excited, so their brains just don't work as efficiently. And then once they start falling behind, they develop anxieties and so on. And we think that's the cause of these, you know, very wide hierarchies that we see in classrooms. But if you make an effort to keep all the kids together, then you get that collective effervescence, which is really exciting.
I know one of the topics that you particularly enjoy teaching and that you've written about quite a bit is fractions. If we go back to what you were saying about the Socratic questioning, yes, for a topic such as fractions, how might that lesson pan out, say, from an early stage?
Well, I think that before we'd even introduce kids to fractions, they'd have to understand a lot about multiplication facts and lowest common multiples of numbers and so on. So that we wouldn't even begin to, we do a brief confidence builder with fractions at the beginning of the year that's not very deep or conceptual. We chose it just because the kids get so excited at being able to do these difficult things and because they learn to stay on task and see patterns and be able to follow some simple rules, which really launches them into the year. But when we come back to it, we don't introduce fractions until we've done an enormous amount of work building basic number sense. So, and I can give you an example. In many, many adults don't really understand, you know, what 2/3 of 9 is. And so we say to the kids, just imagine you have 9 apples or things you're dividing up and put out 3 plates for the thirds. Divide the 9 things up, and we let kids explore that until they completely, we'd start with 1/3, for instance, and we let kids explore that until they completely understand that. They can tell you how many things will end up on each plate, and then we say, well, what about 2/3? And we let them figure that out themselves. There you take 2 plates, and then they begin to understand why you multiply by the 2, because you divide by the 3 because you're dividing the 9 onto the 3 plates, and you would multiply by the 2 because you're taking 2 of them. But the kids are led to that without the teacher having to necessarily tell them explicitly. So through simple models like that, you can all, you know, mathematicians proved 100 years ago that all math can be reduced to very simple steps. Logicians proved that. And so that's how we've tried to structure the lessons. The teacher knows what the most elementary models or explanations are, and they try and get the kids to figure those things out themselves. You know, quite often I think, you know, I've surveyed, I mean, thousands of teachers over the past years and asked them why, when you divide a whole number by a fraction, 7 divided by 2/3, why you flip and multiply. At the Calgary Teachers Convention, someone yelled out, because you get the right answer. And that's how many teachers know that. But if you just take a chocolate bar and show kids how to divide up by a half first, half-sized pieces first, and so on, within a lesson they can discover why you flip and multiply. And when teachers see that, they say, you know, why don't we know this? This is so simple. It's absolutely trivial and obvious. And I think many people are, through no fault of their own, are teaching at a kind of metaphorical or hazy level, well above the real explanation. And the real explanations and models are often very simple. So that's what we're trying to do through our teachers' guides, is help teachers can learn the math by teaching it and see how easy it is.
Is there a risk, John, in breaking topics down into really, really small questions, mm-hmm. that the children end up doing mechanical activities over and over again, mm-hmm. where they're not necessarily being stretched and they're almost on autopilot?
That's a fantastic question, and there is a danger there. And so we do a number of things. I mean, we encourage teachers to start changing the size of the step or having kids take more steps at once as they get more confident. And all of our lessons also come with extension questions. And so those are variations on the idea that kids explore themselves, but at a deeper conceptual level. And the idea is, if typically when kids are given enriched work or more challenging work, it often involves new topics or vocabulary or skills that the teacher might not have taught. And then the faster kids can actually take the teacher's time because the teacher has to work with them. But we tried to create extension questions that don't introduce much new material, so the kids can work independently, and you get three benefits from that. First, the teacher gets a little more time to work with the kids who need it. And often, if you have a well-scaffolded lesson, it could be just a few minutes with the kids to help them. The other thing that we found quite surprising is that the weaker kids start speeding up because they see they can do the questions. They're within their grasp. And then the other thing is the kids cover the curriculum more deeply. You know, they don't just race through it. They get to explore more and understand it more deeply.
One of the things that teachers are encouraged to do in Ireland is to use concrete materials in teaching maths. What is the view of concrete materials in the Jump Maths program?
Well, we virtually everything in Jump, or virtually everything, is taught first through a model. We provide, if teachers don't have the concrete materials, we provide black line masters for them, so that if they had to, they could create these, cut them out and laminate them, or whatever they need to do. But we tend to use very simple concrete materials like base 10 blocks, money, play money, number lines, things like that, because there is some research now that suggests that if there's too many extraneous details in materials or in the approach to teaching, then kids can get distracted and not see the math. So that's why we use simple models generally.
And you mentioned when you were talking about introducing fractions that it would be important that children would know about lowest common multiples and so on. What's your view on learning tables?
Well, you know, I've talked to quite a few cognitive scientists, and there seems to be a growing body of evidence that if kids don't have basic facts and knowledge, then because our working memories are fairly poor, we can only hold a few new things in our head at a time. Kids who don't know their facts tend to get overwhelmed trying to remember. Their brains get filled up trying to remember those things. And so kids who... It seems to be actually a long-term predictor of success if kids know their number facts. So we encourage teachers to teach it through games, patterns, and so on. It doesn't have to be drill and kill, although you do have to practice, but it can be interesting for kids. I even came across some new patterns recently in the 3 and 7 times table that I didn't even see. And in the 6 times table, I don't know if you multiply 6 by an even number. I had no idea. I'm a mathematician. I had no idea until a couple of weeks ago that that the ones digit is the number you're multiplying by. Like 2 times 6 is 12, it's 2. So that already helps you. And then the tens digit is half the ones digit. So it's trivial to multiply 6 by an even number. So through those kind of patterns and so on, kids can learn their tables very quickly. I just wrote an article in Scientific American Mind where I review some of the literature on discovery-based learning on concrete materials and also on sort of basic skills. And I think we need a balance, more of a balance. Discovery is important, but it's also very important to have more practice, guidance. There's a famous cognitive scientist, Herb Simon, who said one of the worst ideas in education is the idea that practice is bad. He said the instructional challenge is how do you make practice interesting? And we think you can do that by raising the bar, by letting kids have success. They'll practice endlessly at math.
In Ireland, the pilot study on jump maths is being introduced in third grade. But what grades have materials been developed for in Canada?
So in Canada, we have grades 1 to 8 now. And we're hoping, as we have more resources, to go higher and also lower. So that's our dream. And we also hope to produce a lot of supplementary materials on problem solving. There's an enormous amount of problem solving in our teachers' guides and in our student materials, but we hope to develop even more material on teaching strategies and also cross-curricular material like math and magic, tricks, math and sports, things like that.
If jump maths is implemented as you envisage, what outcomes would you expect for children who are, say, achieving at an average level, first of all?
Well, I think people think you have to make a choice between taking care of your weaker students and boring your fast ones, or taking care of your faster ones and leaving kids behind. We have data from master teachers that suggests you can bring the entire class, almost without exception, along at the same rate and a much faster rate than you'd expect. So in the studies we've done, including a randomized controlled study, the faster students have always done better in jump. It's not like you have to hold kids back. But the middle and bottom have in some cases, really approached the top level quite dramatically. Like the bell curve is really closed or narrowed. So I have very radical beliefs. I think if kids were, had great programs from kindergarten, that within a few years, I think that virtually all students, I would say 98% at least, would be doing as well as our stronger students do now. So I think we could have a much higher standard, and loving math, like really loving the subject. And I don't even want to make a prediction about the 2%, the challenged 2%, because I've taught some very, very challenged kids, and they've surprised me too. And I think we're gradually learning how to remediate some disabilities in mathematics. And I expect that eventually, virtually every kid will be able to learn math at a high level.
And children learning maths is one aspect of your work, but also you're hoping that teachers can learn to teach maths and to teach jump maths in the way that you recommend. How difficult will that be, do you think? Because these teachers, maybe many of them have been teaching maths in possibly a different way for several years.
I'm very optimistic. I think the difficulties aren't with teachers, it's with the system. The system doesn't allow teachers to innovate, to get proper training, to use materials that are evidence-based and have research behind them. So teachers get very frustrated because they... I think the teachers, the ones we work with in Canada, are so happy to try something, to keep data on their kids, to do action research. The vast majority of teachers we've seen are extremely excited when they get good materials, and they're incredibly excited about learning the math well. We had two really math-phobic teachers in Vancouver who eventually went on to do masters in math education and are now training other teachers. So we've seen that a lot. I think that if school boards would allow teachers to experiment and also give them some support to become master teachers, then very quickly I think teachers could mentor other teachers and raise the standards very significantly in a short time. We've seen a kind of explosive movement in some places in Canada where teachers have been allowed to use jump.
I've seen some of your teaching materials, and I think teachers might be surprised at the absence of colour and maybe fun characters and things like that in them. How would you respond to that?
Well, our intuitions aren't always that great. There's a researcher, her name is Kaminsky. I mentioned her work in my Scientific American Mind article. She surveyed teachers and asked them whether kids would learn better from colorful pictures of stacked objects in bar graphs, or would they learn better from monochromatic gray bars? And most teachers chose the colorful object, like if the graph was about shoes, it would be stacked shoes, because it was relevant, it was a picture of what the graph was about, it was colorful. But it turns out the kids learn better from the gray bars, because the kids who had the stacked objects tend to focus too much on counting the objects, and they didn't learn to read the scale well. So we've tried to make the books simple without a lot of distractors. We introduce language very carefully so that that doesn't become a barrier. We've tried to take away all the barriers so that very quickly weaker students could start to catch up. And we use our extension questions to enrich the lessons. Those are delivered by the teacher. But the student materials we try and make as student-friendly as possible and as simple. The layout and everything as simple as possible. And we just did a study in New York City, and one of the researchers from Johns Hopkins University were surprised that the kids said that they loved our books because they looked like books for older kids. They didn't have a lot of cartoons and so on. They looked like just really hardcore math.
How would you describe the educational philosophy or theory that underlies Jump Maths?
Well, we're just trying to figure that out ourselves. You know, I'm a mathematician and only developed this through my own experience, volunteering in classrooms and teaching myself. And then we brought together a team of writers, mathematicians, and educators. And so it's really hasn't been theory driven so much as practice. But we're realizing now that what we're doing does seem to be well supported by educational theory and cognitive science. So I think the best we can do is we call it guided discovery, and the two words are equally important. I do believe that inquiry is important and that kids should investigate and discover and explain as much as they can, but lessons have to be very well scaffolded. There was just a meta-analysis that came out in the Journal of Educational Psychology a couple years ago, and they found that discovery, pure discovery, doesn't work, but if it's combined with explicit teaching, scaffolding, lots of feedback, elicited explanations from the students and so on, then it works. And that's sort of what we've settled on in the trenches.
In your book, The End of Ignorance, you write about the importance of getting children's attention. Mm-hmm. How do you propose that teachers can get children's attention, particularly if they're maybe disengaged from the subject of maths?
Well, I'm a playwright also, and when I started going into classrooms, I thought of the kids as an audience, and the only advantage we have of putting kids in a group is that they're an audience, and they'll never get more excited than they will in a group. It's better to keep them as a group rather than pulling off kids to get individual attention, unless they are really far behind. If you can keep the whole class together, then you have a performance, and then you got their attention. It becomes this kind of magnifier for attention. Now, if you start picking out certain kids as the talented ones, you've destroyed the audience effect. You've destroyed attention. If you don't scaffold the lesson so one idea sort of naturally leads to the next, if you make the steps too big, you just destroy attention. So I found my lessons go best, suppose I'm teaching the kids about patterns or something, if I just milk it a bit, like spend a little longer letting the kids play with the patterns, look at the patterns, let everyone see what's there. We find the faster kids don't get bored. They get actually excited by the fact that everyone else is excited. And you can always, if you know the math, you can always just come up with a little bonus or a little extension. But I think the best way to grab attention is to keep the class together. And I think we do a horrible disservice to kids by constantly creating these hierarchies and making half the class feel inferior. It's totally unnecessary.
Finally, John, you're in Ireland for a very short visit. If there was one message you wanted to leave behind with Irish teachers from your visit here, what would it be?
Well, I'm so excited to be here because I think there's an openness and... just a curiosity and a willingness to try things here from the people I've met that's very exciting, and I would hope people would really take advantage of that. It's I as a playwright, most of my favorite writers are from Ireland. It's a country that has an incredible culture, and I could imagine, it's such an intelligent culture that I could imagine if teachers had the the permission to experiment and to keep data on kids and to communicate with each other, I think that Ireland could be a world leader in education, in mathematics education.
And that brings this week's Inside Education to a close. I want to thank my guest, John Mighton, for taking part. If you have a suggestion for a future programme, please contact me through the website seandelaney.com. Thanks for listening this week, and I'll be back with another podcast soon.